I'm Stephen M. Hall, MD, an integral physician.
And I'm Grace Porter, a licensed psychotherapist. And together, we're the 7 Tools, a company focused on your personal growth and transformation.
And you are here with us for the Change for Good Summit. This year, we're focusing on building resilience in anxious times.
This summit is full of deep conversation and practical advice. We hope you enjoy this interview.
So now let's dive in. Hello again. This is Stephen Hall with the 2019 Change for Good Summit, Building Resilience in Anxious Times. I'm really excited for you to hear what our next speaker has to say because, no question, problems that seem too big to solve yet affect all of us definitely contribute to these being anxious times. And perhaps no problem fits into this category better than the climate crisis. So Dr. Haas has some things to say about this that could help us all, and especially our children, who are going to have to live out their lives in this world that we've created. So Dr. Haas is a medical director of behavioral health at Carson Tahoe Regional Medical Center and an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Nevada in Reno. In her other time, can't imagine there would be, but there must be. She works on raising awareness of climate mental health impacts through writing, presentations, and advocacy with the Climate Psychiatry Alliance, which hopefully we'll talk about a little bit. So current projects include papers on working with climate anxiety in psychotherapy and how suicide may be associated with climate change, and continued work on her film about preparing children for their climate future called Frogs in a Pot with Jessica Haller and John Felix.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So welcome, Dr. Haas. Can you tell us a little more about yourself and how you got interested in the effects of climate on your patients?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up using the lakes nearby when I wanted solace. So I've always had a great sort of attachment to nature in that way. And I raised 2 really beautiful daughters in New York City. And when they were done growing up, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with the time that would be open. And I really felt like whatever I could do to help with the climate change crisis was the thing that I should do. And because I'm a psychiatrist, I should try to do something about that, you know. And there was a moment when somebody came to my house with huge clear plastic sheets on both sides of cupcakes so that they could protect the cupcakes and keep the icing perfect, where I really thought, I have to do this right now because we cannot continue to throw away 5 sheets of plastic for every 10 cupcakes that we're placing on a beautiful tray. So I sort of started to devote myself to it at that point. But, you know, it's really about what has been most meaningful to me over my life as a source of solace and comfort and wanting to protect that and protect that future for my girls and maybe their children too.
Oh, great. So yeah, I've heard you use the word eco-anxiety. What is eco-anxiety? How do you define that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are trying to define it right now, you know, because initially it was actually used pejoratively as a way to sort of say that paying too much attention to the environment creates an unnecessary distress syndrome, right? And then there was a study that was done about that, and what they really showed is that people who had more environmental concern actually had more proactive behaviors, were more resilient, were more externally oriented in terms of solving problems in the community. So that idea that it's not healthy has been sort of debunked. But you know, now there is sort of awareness of the different kinds of distress that people have about climate. And there's sort of some terms that are thrown around for that, right? So particularly crediting George Albrecht, who's a professor in Australia, who's written a lot about climate-related anxiety and has a new book out about emotions and climate change and has developed this term solastalgia.
What is that term?
Solastalgia. Which is a term that's used for the kind of grief and sorrow that you feel and the kind of nostalgia, kind of combining the two. Sort of nostalgia and sadness as you see the world around you change particularly your local habitat. So it's a grief for the planets and the plants and the animals that are changing around you. And that's one kind of distress, you know. And then there's people that have a kind of Cassandra syndrome, where they're very anxious about climate change, and they've been speaking up about it now for some of them 20 or 30 years. And they're treated as if they're crazy for bringing it up, which creates its own kind of distress, right? They get ignored so repeatedly, or their efforts fail so repeatedly, that it becomes really demoralizing and can create a lot of anxiety and depression.
Well, they maybe start to wonder if their perceptions are accurate, when, right? Nobody believes them.
You know, I think most of them feel that their perceptions are accurate. It's really the grief of not being able to get your message through, you know. And being, you know, negatively labeled for trying also, you know. And I think some of the other sort of anxiety syndromes are this idea of pre-traumatic anxiety. So instead of PTSD, meaning post-traumatic stress disorder, we have sort of pre-traumatic stress disorder. And it's sort of exactly as what you might think it would be, is that you're sort of living in dread of what's going to come and very vigilant to that and having panic attacks about the future and sort of constantly preoccupied and ruminating with it, you know. So these are sort of the formal anxiety syndromes, you know. The more sort of prevalent kind of distress, right, is a general worry that's kind of population-wide at this point. You know, what's going to become of us? What's going on with this climate change? You know, the fear of the unknown, the fear of the uncertainty, the fear of the passivity from leadership, you know. So that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's interesting. These are actually getting names and there's research. People are starting to do research on these different kinds of anxiety.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to know a little bit about that, you know, there was initially a lot of descriptive research, qualitative research, looking at the emotions of the Inuits in Northern Labrador and the Aborigines in Australia and different places where the climate is changing more rapidly and more dramatically, and just sort of describing what they were going through. There are starting to be some studies. I mean, there really have been remarkably few studies. But there are some studies now of pre-traumatic anxiety, right? So if you're anticipating something, what happens then when it actually happens, right? How does that change the outcome? And there's starting to be a little bit of look, not really psychiatric look, but psychological studies of people who've been through repeated traumas or a place where the whole community has been traumatized, like the kids in Santa Rosa after the fire and things like that. But that research is actually just very, very recent. You'd be surprised how recent it is.
Yeah. Wow. So how do you see these kinds of anxieties manifesting in your patients? And you alluded to it's different than other kinds of anxieties. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when I said that it's different, right, what I meant was is that it's important to think about it differently. Because often in psychology or in psychiatry, what we're trying to do is reduce people's anxiety, right? The hypothesis is this person's coming in because they have excess anxiety. The anxiety is disproportionate to the situation. So the job of the therapist or the doctor is to help them learn techniques for reducing their anxiety, yeah? With the idea that they don't actively respond to it in the moment, yeah? And if you think about something like the trade towers going down, right, 9/11, you don't want to be chilling out at that time. So when you have a real anxiety situation, you need to respond to it with real action and real change in your behavior. And that requires some sort of different techniques, particularly kind of in acute situations, practicing in advance, right, engaging in advance so that when those things come up, they're not overwhelming. You have automatic thoughts and mechanisms built into your body. This is what I do in this situation, which allows your mind to function when it becomes more overwhelmed. So it's a little bit different, and it's important that psychiatrists begin to think of it differently and psychologists begin to think of it differently. I don't really want to work with this in the same way. I want to help the person put this into some sort of action that transforms their anxiety, manages their anxiety through action, but doesn't seek to really reduce it per se.
Right, because it's very likely not disproportionate to the situation.
Exactly.
So can you give our listeners an example of like some of the tools you might give one of your clients with eco-anxiety? Like, how do they turn that? Well, this is another question, I don't know, but like, how do they turn that anxiety into action?
Well, you know, transformation on any level of resilience, right? I mean, so the fundamental nature of resilience is that it has to be layered. It has to be multi-layered, right? Mm. So things like how to manage yourself in an acute situation, right, are really important. So being able to, you know, meditate so that you can observe yourself as you go through difficult things, that's a good skill. Being able to be mindful of all the details around you is really helpful when they're changing rapidly and you need to pay attention to things. You know, practicing techniques for self-soothing and creating small safe spaces around you, sort of mini safe spaces, right, when you're in a difficult situation. Those kinds of things are really helpful, and those are kind of traditional anxiety techniques, right?
Mm-hmm.
Noticing what level of arousal your body is in and what you can do about that, so that if you're really, really anxious, maybe you need to run around the block, right, before you're going to be able to calm down. Right? If you're having a panic attack, maybe you need to breathe differently for a while. Right? So it's not that the traditional anxiety management techniques aren't effective, but it's also helpful to feel competent, to have strategies for being courageous, to have strategies for telling a different story than what's being told to you, for having practiced ways of engaging a problem, whatever that problem is. Right? And so when you think about climate stuff, that can be anything from being confident that you know what the content of soil is by testing it on your fingertips and tasting it. You know how to identify some edible plants, and you know how to grow a garden. You know how to build a shelter under duress. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe even you even know how to shoot a gun because there might be more instability around you, right? So there are a lot of very practical techniques that people might want to think about. But the more important things are about transforming yourself and transforming the community around you in a positive direction, in a way that builds cooperation, in a way that builds mutual understanding and shared problem solving, so that we can both under duress and immediately now begin to work together. And how can we make, you know, this watershed more resilient? How can our community have a plan in place if all the pharmacies get flooded? Things like that. So it's about engaging the problem much more than traditional anxiety treatment. And if you feel powerless with your leaders, have you written to them? Have you created a coalition of, you know, 5 or 10 people that's working on a particular aspect of the problem? I mean, I know for me, I started becoming curious about this question. I started asking the question by filming some interviews, which led to the movie. And then through that, I met one psychiatrist, and then I met another psychiatrist. And now we have this group of 10 people plus 400 people on a listserv, and we are incredibly busy with this problem. And we've passed lots of action papers getting the psychiatric profession to get going on this. And we've written lots of articles, and we've given lots of talks about, you know, the different health issues related to mental health. And so once you start engaging it, your tiny corner of the universe can become much more active and much more well adapted, you know, and understanding of what's coming.
Yeah, I want to get back to that too, if that's all right. But I have this other burning question, because I've been spending a lot of time lately, and my wife's actually getting sick of me saying, I don't understand, or this boggles my mind, or, you know, because I'm really having a hard time comprehending that we're even going in this direction, kind of. So climate anxiety is obviously going to be more of an issue for people who actually believe in climate change. But in your opinion, as a psychiatrist, that's what I'm curious about is, so what do you think is going on in the minds of people who, so even in the face of arguably like the most scientifically corroborating data of any issue in modern times, that they still persist in denying climate change? What do you think is going on inside of their heads?
Different things. I mean, first of all, you know, I think yesterday there was a study that 40% of Republicans believe that Trump didn't mention the Ukraine in the letter that he submitted to Congress for the impeachment hearings. And that's just inaccurate, right? And so when 40% of people are being fed misinformation about something,
right? And they believe it.
And they believe it. They actually don't know, right? So there's been, you know, as you know, decades of people being planted to foster this denial and create alternative scenarios, which, you know, and if that's all you're exposed to, that may be all that you know, right? But I think for a lot of people, you know, Naomi Klein said that it's not that they don't know, it's that they are aware of how much of their life is going to have to change. And that's profoundly threatening. If you really think you're going to have a total overhaul of your entire economic system and your lifestyle, which
it is overwhelming to think about.
The tendency to deny that reality and is, you know, very strong. And we see that much more, you know, at this point, it's a very small percentage of Americans that deny that climate change exists. There are a lot of people that are worried about it at different levels. And the more common defense is disavowal, right? Which is that the problem is so big,
right,
and your life is churning along with the engine that has been developed.
People are so busy with everything else.
And, you know, the airplane is there and the car is there and, you know, you give a birthday party and you get some balloons, you know, and all these things are not really consonant with a sustainable adaptation to the planet, right, until we develop new biodegradable balloons. But in the meantime, we have to live in this kind of double think where we know what we're doing is destructive, but we have to act like it's not in order to be normal. In order to kind of fit in and in order to take care of our kids and, you know, not deprive them and, you know, get along with the other parents and all these things. So that creates this real schism for people,
right? Right?
You know, in what they're doing and what they're thinking. And that's very anxiety producing. One of the most effective parts of beginning to work on climate stuff is that when you really get it, you really process, wow, I really can't fly as much as I used to because it feels bad. And it feels bad because it makes me unconsciously anxious to know that every time I fly, I'm harming something.
Yeah.
So then you start to offset your flights. You cut your flights in half. And you notice that you've got all this free time because you're not traveling so much. You're not spending so much time at the airport. And it feels more relaxing also. Because not only are you not moving around in this kind of frenzied way, but what you feel about taking care of the planet and what you're doing on a day-to-day basis match. And so you get that sense of authenticity that comes from living in a way that's consistent with your values, you know, living in a way that's consistent with what you care about.
And those are likely going to be incremental changes probably, right?
Absolutely. But every time you make one, you can feel yourself relax. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, denial, yes, it's very hard to deal with that. I mean, I think another thing that a lot of people have suggested is that this idea of displacement, right? And just as we know from old, you know, psychoanalytic theories, when you're really worried or really angry because your house isn't clean, you might not get mad at your boyfriend about that, right? But you might get mad at him because he left a cup in the car. Things sort of slide into something else. And so, for example, you know, Zika virus is a disease that's migrating northward because of warmer temperatures, in part. There are other reasons for Zika virus migrating, but that's part of the reason. So you might see this real hysteria about Zika virus, but not see it connected to any awareness of climate change and changing temperatures.
And changing personal behaviors.
Yeah, so that sort of slide into other kinds of anxieties.
So I bet, you know, in thinking about this, I bet you're right. There's probably a lot more people who, I mean, they admit that climate change is real, but you're right that they don't know what to do on a personal level. They've been told that, well, if they cut down their driving a little bit, that's an insignificant contribution compared to coal-fired power plants or whatever. And so why bother? And so that at least to that, like paralysis sort of, or what to do. So you have suggestions about how to work with that? I bet there's a lot more people that want to do something, but they don't know how to get themselves going.
Yeah, and I think that that's really the important psychotherapy question, right? And the important personal processing question. And I, you know, far be it from me to claim that I have an answer, but I can talk a little bit about what some people have been thinking about, what we've been thinking about. And I think that first thing is to become aware that this is a very big thing to think about. Okay. And so often when you think about it, there's a tendency to become overwhelmed and kind of shut down. And so as you begin to think about it, you need to create some sort of containment for yourself, some sort of idea of a structure or a place or a person where you can have that conversation in a leisurely way when you're not super uptight. And that might be a therapist, that might be a group of people that you hang out with and talk about it. But the idea is that the very first thing you need to do is slow down and give yourself some time to think about it. And one metaphor that we have found helpful is the idea of the baby, not in the sense of baby-ish, but in the sense of we are all coming to this pretty new. And as we sort of wake up to the realities of it, if we shut ourselves down feeling anxious or guilty because we're at fault or stupid because we don't have all the answers right away, we're only going to harm ourselves and cut the discussion off at the very beginning. And so if you think, you know, all of us are becoming more and more aware of this thing that's been going on, we've got more information, we're sort of waking up to it, but we can't take responsibility for that. You can only be aware of what you've been aware of up to now. And then we come into a situation which is truly new. It's new for all of us. And if you give yourself the metaphor of a baby coming into the world, it's a helpful metaphor for a couple of reasons. One is babies learn fast.
They do.
Right? The babies are charged with the task of rapid adaptation. But they're not charged for blaming, you know, when things don't go fast enough or they don't get it right the first time around.
Or it's not their fault. They don't know it already.
Exactly. Yeah. And so if you come with this idea that you're fundamentally innocent as you approach this, because you can only know what you can know, you can only you can do, and you can only change so fast, even though rapid change made for, and that you're like a kid, right, who has the opportunity now to soak up all of this information and go, wow, what a cool new world we're in. I love this new world. It's really groovy, right? You know, it's got all this great stuff in it, you know, and it does. It has more time. It has more time outdoors. I mean, I have not spoken with any person in the last 2 years who did not say when asked, how are things? What's been good? The answer from everybody is, I took a really nice hike. I played with my dog. I hung out and listened to the wind, you know. Yeah. Nobody says I stood in front of the window of a store with blingy things and felt relaxed and happy.
You haven't heard anybody say that yet?
They're craving this engagement, you know, really craving this engagement. I'm sure there are people that are very excited by that, and I'm probably, you know, selected group, but really people, that experience of, you know, that experience of awe in nature, that experience of sunshine is just the most powerful thing for almost everybody, you know, when you really ask them.
Well, that's actually, just to let you know, very consistent message from just about every one of our speakers is, you know, if you want to help with, want help with anxiety, connect with nature.
Oh, for sure. So engaging that innocence, engaging that idea that there is a new possibility out there. You are in a new world. And just like a baby, you're wordless. You don't quite have the language for that new world yet. You don't have all the understanding of that new world yet. It's going to be a little chaotic and confusing at times, but you have the capacity for rapid change and growth.
And adaptation. Kids are very adaptable too.
Yeah, for sure. Really super adaptable.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that adults struggle with, is that kind of doublethink between, I know that rapid change is called for, but I also know that the world only moves so fast, and that can be really distressing. And so opening up again more space to kind of think about that. And part of that container, right? Part of that giving yourself the space is to allow some very deep, sometimes dark, but ultimately therapeutic, settling into the depth of the problem. So there's a beautiful article by Jim Bendel called Deep Adaptation, in which he talks about being a climate scientist and realizing that things are going poorly and there are going to be some things that he's going to witness in his lifetime that are going to be very sad and distressing. And allowing that to soak in, and that when you allow yourself to grieve that and feel very sad about it, and to realize that there's not that much you can do about it, it opens up a space for you to then just sit and go, wow, what does that mean for me? And through that kind of rumination, it's called positive rumination, right? Rather than sort of negative, panicky rumination. It's quite freeing, right? It's like, you know, I've hit bottom. There's no place to go from here except, okay, that's going to be the way that it is. I'm going to have lost a lot. Other people are going to have lost a lot. And it's very freeing. So what do I want to do now? And I think the other idea that I have found very helpful is from Jonathan Lear, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, who wrote a book called Radical Hope, which is about a Crow Indian chief who was faced with the fact that his people were being wiped out both by the Sioux Indians and by the white man, and that their way of life, their entire value system was under threat. And if he continued to persist in fighting, which was their creed, right, was to be strong and powerful and fight their enemies in a particular way, that everything would be destroyed. And he had this vision in a dream, actually quite early in life, at age 9, which came back to him when he was faced with this challenge. And the vision was of white spotted animals coming out of a hole in the ground and spreading across the land. And at the time, he had never seen a cow. He didn't know about white men. Right? He only had buffalo.
Right.
But because he relied on his vision from childhood and he trusted that, he relinquished his entire value system. He sold his people out to the white man. He took a smaller reservation. And they really had to give up every way of thinking and being as a people that they knew. Every aspect of what it meant to be proud as a man was to be a proud warrior. They lost a lot of land, which was their nurturance. But he believed in the power of his spiritual vision enough that if he trusted it, even though he didn't have words for what was going to come, because he saw that the current system was not working, he trusted the vision to help his people be led to some sort of survival, which I forgot to say. The cows came out of the ground and his people survived in his early childhood vision.
Yeah, they weren't totally eradicated.
Not totally
eradicated. Genocide, pretty close, but not all.
Pretty close. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, we're not talking about pretty pictures here, but at least you can find some space in which to work through, okay, I don't have words for this. I don't have images for how it's going to be. I don't know what's going to come. It's confusing and chaotic. It's beyond me. But I have some means of processing it, which open up space. And if I don't have space to think and feel, I'm just going to shut down.
Yeah.
In one way or another. Right? Either through denial, I'm not going to deal with it. It's not happening. Or through sort of catastrophe, there's absolutely no hope, nothing I can do.
Yeah, that's a hard way to live, yeah.
Yeah, you can't collapse like that. You've got to stop yourself from that kind of collapse.
So, yeah, that's been coming up a lot, interestingly, in several different directions. Remember that Native American tale of the two wolves inside fighting? Mm-hmm. And one is hopeful and one is destructive. And the grandson asked the grandpa, well, which wolf wins? And the grandpa says, whichever one you feed. Mm-hmm. And you have a choice which wolf to feed, but we all have the two wolves fighting inside.
Yeah.
But what you mentioned reminds me of just a general technique in therapy in general is to really open to the truth in the moment. Mm-hmm. Just really open to the truth in the moment. And even when it's painful and, like I said, dark and But a lot of it, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So just being with that, not knowing, imagine you have some suggestions for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that acceptance and commitment therapy is a type of therapy that's very good in this situation, right? The idea that you have to accept the realities of the situation. There are a lot of things that are beyond your control. And then the idea also of acting on your personal value system, mm-hmm. acting with integrity to your best self.
Well, that's going to be really important as, like I said, as change keeps getting thrust upon us.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. I think you've actually gone on and answered a few of my other questions. So let's just see if there's anything else. So how do we deal with our own despair and overwhelm, especially when it leads to inaction? So you talked about that, like we can't let ourselves collapse.
Yeah.
We've got to have create a safe space for ourselves to talk about these things and feel these things, whether it's with a therapist or with a good, close group of friends or whatever. Right.
I think, just the other part of that, those two wolves that we've been thinking about a little bit, is the idea that you don't actually want to feed, in this particular case, either wolf. Right? So one of the things that can happen, right, is that with climate change, you're faced with a lot of things that are diametrically opposed. They are in a dialectic relationship with each other. And they create a kind of difficulty of thinking. So, for example, we're told simultaneously, this is a global problem. No one person is going to be able to change it. And also, only your actions can change this. It's up to every individual to take total control of the situation. And how are you supposed to think about that? Like, I'm not supposed to do anything. I'm supposed to let the leaders lead, or I have to do everything myself. I shouldn't count on them. And if you go to either side of that, I have no power, or I'm totally powerfully responsible for whatever I do. And, all of this creates problems, right? So if you're powerfully responsible for climate change by all of your actions, not only is the obligation for dramatic change beyond anybody's ability to change, right?
And still stay in the society, right?
Yeah, the guilt and the exhaustion is just going to get you down. And if you are powerless, right, you don't bear any responsibility, then you don't really have to do much at all, right? It's all up to the other guys. And so try not to stay on one side or another of that is really important. Yes, I have a lot of personal power in my decisions. And with that power comes some responsibility. And also great capability. But I don't stop there. I also think, but much of this is beyond my control. It will require larger action.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it's not all about my individual action. It's also about the group's action and the leader's action. So I can't just become, somebody who lives a sustainable lifestyle in a tree hut, right?
Right.
I also have to go out and be with my neighbors at the candy dance. And I have to, run for office. And, I have to do things that are civic as well. And I have to be aware that I will only get so far. And so other people need to be empowered. Other people need to be supported. Right? And that relieves me of my responsibility. So all of these kind of dialectics, just remembering not to collapse them. You're neither totally hopeful, because that would turn you into a kind of Pollyanna, and it'll keep you from doing the kind of deep work of really processing some things, nor are you hopeless and paralyzed by your hopelessness and you give up. So with each position comes problems, is the idea. But if you keep both of them open, you can embrace a richer, more nuanced way of thinking.
Yeah, so one of the things I've been just working on in my own development is trying to watch myself for when I get caught into that either or thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And look and see if there's an and way of seeing it.
That's a beautiful, easy technique. Yeah.
Is that's kind of what we're seeing, right? Or hold space for both possibilities and put them together and see how they talk to each other or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And the only thing I'm adding here, is that in climate, it may be particularly important because of the scale of the problem. and the nature of some of the realities that we're confronted with. That it's even more black and white, and the double think of, you know, generativity versus we're all dying, you know, at a, like in a stage of your life when you're trying to be generative, you are also confronted with the reality that everything around you may not generate, right? So these kind of, when you find yourself in that kind of double think, that that's, it's a particular challenge in climate change for a lot of things, right? All your expectations are kind of turned on their head, you know, things that are hopeful were no longer hopeful, and these are tricky things.
Yeah. And then, so what if the unthinkable actually does happen, you know, such as if the struggle over water or the, you know, migration of displaced populations triggering major wars, how can we prepare psychologically for these kind of eventualities? And maybe even better, how do we prepare ourselves to work toward their prevention?
Yeah, I think prevention, you know, I think it's hard to say, you know, I haven't lived through a major genocide. I think several things. First of all, we know that when you really, really confront any anxiety, right, the worst thing that could happen is that the people that you care about, including you, might die. Mm-hmm. If you really allow yourself to go into what would that be like, it usually doesn't last too long, and then it's kind of over, right? And so even if the worst happens and your, you know, your family is killed by a hurricane or, you know, war breaks out and people die and things, understanding that the actual experience of it can only be severely painful and horrible for so long, I personally have found to be comforting. And, you know, you can kind of work with people to get them to understand how, you know, even jumping off the World Trade Tower knowing you're going to die, it's only 5 or 10 minutes of your life.
That's
the grimmest, most kind of macabre part of this, right? The other parts are, how do you live with the fact that you may witness prolonged destruction and suffering? What are the psychological mechanisms for coping with that kind of witnessing? And I think that Lori Nadal is a psychologist who's written a little bit about this and thought about this. And there are certain gifts psychologically. Humility is one. Patience is another. And understanding that there is always growth is a third. And that often those are gifts that we have received from indigenous cultures and older cultures. Mm-hmm. So studying the values of indigenous cultures who have seen their cultures come and go, who have risen up after an entire population was decimated by smallpox, that understanding that we are part of something so much larger than ourselves, the tiny little speck that we are in this universe, is an extremely comforting thing. And, you know, things will change and then they will change again, you know. And so maybe some reading about those cycles of life, understanding of the seven generation theory from the Native American people, consideration of things, the cosmos and the universe and our place within it, and then of higher spiritual, more cyclical, transcendent kinds of ways of thinking, along with humility and patience for a small situation. Those can be helpful values, you know, as you process this.
Yeah, and that's Laura Nadalis, you said, writes about that?
A lovely psychologist book called The Five Gifts.
Five Gifts. Yeah, I haven't heard of that one. Okay. But it makes sense. And that idea that there's always a possibility for growth hidden in every single moment, that's definitely an idea from wisdom traditions down through the centuries.
But even if we are not generative, even if, you know, the planet is generative, new life forms emerge.
Right. One other thing you mentioned was attachment theory. And can you explain attachment theory to us and how that might help inform this progress in there towards climate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of goes back to the very beginning when we were talking about how attached we are to the world, our experiences of awe in relationship to the natural world. You know, psychology, I think, has made a kind of fundamental mistake This is not universally true, but you know, most attachment theory is focused on people attaching to people.
Right, to the mother especially, yeah.
Yeah, mother, caregiver, you know, attaching to your friends. And we have ideas about separation anxiety and panic disorder because we're not securely attached to the people that can protect us. What's missing there is that we don't only attach to the world or to people, we attach to the outside world. Mm. We go out from mommy, right? We go out and we go play in the yard and we go play with our dog and we pick a plant, right? And that process of securely going out into the world and connecting to it is another way of being securely attached, but it's secure attachment to nature. And it recognizes that we have a relationship with nature, just like we have a relationship with our mom. And that just as she takes care of us, the world takes care of us, that it's a mutual and symbiotic relationship. And I've personally found this to be a very profound metaphor because I work with so many people who are scared to walk out of their doors, right? Mm. You know, we have so many people who are agoraphobic, who, you know, feel so constricted because they aren't securely connected to the outside world in all of its manifestations, the crowds and the trees and the speed and the, you know,
yeah,
scary animals and dangerous ocean. So that the idea of trying to raise children who are securely attached to the natural world in a loving and kind way, who know that they can go out and be safe with it and it will take care of them, and that they then have an obligation to take care of it. You know, and we all know this from pets, right? All mm-hmm. of us know that we have a connection to the natural world through our animals and that they take care of us and we take care of them. But to extend that metaphor to everything that comes out of the ground, all the ways in which we are cared for,
yeah,
all the ways in which we are connected and attached to it. I think adding the idea of attachment theory to that, that we need to change our attachment theory to include that as one of the secure attachments that we want kids to develop, is very powerful, both in terms of climate change and developing more mutual relationships, but also in terms of helping people to feel safe going outside of themselves. Yeah.
So I think that's excellent advice. So it's interesting to me. So when I was a kid, I grew up in this neighborhood with a lot of other kids, and we were always outside. We had fields we could go play in, orchards, old abandoned orchards we could go play in. And one of the worst punishments my parents could make for us is to have to stay inside.
Right.
And right? Yeah. And we got back at them because we would then hang around and drive them crazy. So they would let us go back outside again. But the but nowadays you hardly ever see any kids outside.
Yeah.
And so what do you suggest for parents to try to get their kids away from their video games and out into nature? What, and especially if they're in cities where nature might not be very accessible.
Yeah, but, you know, most cities have parks that are reasonable interview. You know, I think parents getting over their interval, rather. I think parents getting over their own fears is important. But, you know, best practices in terms of how much screen time you allow your kids will do the trick, right? Mm-hmm. You just take away their phones and their iPads after an hour and a half, right? But also starting early so that they're really connected to that stuff early. Mm-hmm. Pets and gardens are obviously really good things. Safe experiences in water when they're very young. And, you know, once a kid has a sense of the awe of nature, the real beauty of it, they don't lose it, right? So any experience of delight with snow, playfulness, you know, any experience in a butterfly, you know, sanctuary that they'll build in a city, right? These are experiences that stay with kids, right? That they really seek out. Yeah.
Okay. Well, those are very excellent advice. So moving on, I don't think I've ever met a practicing physician who is also a film producer. So can you tell us about Future Perfect Media Productions and the film you're currently working on? That's fascinating.
Yeah, well, Yeah, it's been fascinating for me. I mean, this is really how I got interested in all this stuff. I was on an environmental group board in my neighborhood, and I had a friend there who had done a lot of environmental work, and she happens to have four kids, and they come in two and two, two little ones and two that are 10 years older. And she was like, really distressed, you know, like, what am I supposed to be doing with my kids to get them ready for this world that they're going to be facing? And she turned to me as a psychiatrist, and I said, I don't know, but it's a really good question. And my partner is a filmmaker, and he said, well, that's a really good question. And she happens to have been in the very first group of people that Al Gore worked with. And he would take them out to dinner every night, and they would have these long conversations. So because of that, she knew a lot of people. She had met Bill McGibbon, and she knew Larry Schwager, and she knew all these people. And so we said, okay, you know, we're going to go around and ask these people, what should we do with our kids today, right, to get them ready for this climate change future? And we went out and we talked to a lot of really famous people, and they had some really good things to say, you know, raise moral kids, raise kids that are connected to nature, raise kids that understand what a fact and science is, you know.
what an idea.
You know, how to evaluate facts. But every single one of them also said, in terms of the emotional piece, I have no idea. I've never thought about this question before. Which is remarkable, because these were 20-year climate leaders who had not thought about what the emotional needs of children would be going forward.
Right? And that's how we got started, right?
That's how we got started making the movie. And, you know, we got $70,000 and we went out and we spent it doing a bunch of interviews, and then we got stuck for 5 years, you know, and her life changed and my life changed, and we ran into all of the realities of this, trying to make this stuff happen. And so now we're going for one final round of funding on it. And I really hope we get it, because there really are answers now, and there really are people to talk to about it. There are people that are doing remarkable, innovative things to help children grow emotionally in this way of telling new stories and evolving and transforming. And I was talking to Betty Ray Shard just recently. She's working on rites of passage for kids to put them through a scary, traumatic situation from which they emerge more courageous and more grounded and more empowered. You know, there's so many new ways of thinking about how to engage kids with this. So that film has been quite a journey, and I hope it'll get out there, because I think that our experience as moms, finding out what to do for our families, is an experience that a lot of people are wanting to have and talk about. And so that's really the idea right now, is that the film will be an educational film for people to get the question started, show a little bit of our journey, and then they can talk about it, you know, further themselves and take it up in their own way.
Yeah. That sounds like it would be a really amazing resource. That would be great.
Hope so. I really hope so.
So, and you and your partners named it Future Perfect Production. So when I thought about that, it makes me wonder if perhaps you have a vision of what you would like to see happen in the future. What, you want to share that? What vision do you have for the climate future?
Oh, that's funny. It makes me shy. you know, I would love to see people living in reasonable sized communities with shared spaces and sustainable systems within that community. I think my own experience now living in a community of 70,000 people is just a beautiful one. There's a certain size at which people can really relate well to each other, and really experiencing the joy of not being so materially connected. It's just, to be outdoors with the stars and with your animals is so much better. But I'm maybe a bit naive. But
no, I can really relate, because for the last 20 years, we lived on a little 14-acre farm and grew pretty much all of our own food. And we grew it organically and biodynamically. And about a year ago, we had to move for various reasons. And man, I don't know how those people that lost their farms after being on them for generations, how they, you know,
How did you get to this work that you're doing? Is that part of it?
No, I was actually been in practice quite a while, you know, 33 some odd years. And I got interested in people that medicine had no good answers for. People that, we had a hard time really helping and trying to find a better way to help those people. And so that's what got me searching other healing traditions around the world. know, nutrition and herbs and energy medicine. I really found that I had a knack for the hands-on body work. I like to work with my hands and like do a lot of woodwork and that kind of thing. So I've just been doing that in my practice for many, many years, helping people basically connect with their own deep knowing. Mm-hmm. And seeing how their own deep knowing helps them solve their life's problems or what suggestions it might have for them anyway. Right. And that's where that those seven tools came from, is I saw a pattern to how people's inner knowing helped them. Mm-hmm. And trying to just tell yourself to change doesn't work very well. No, but there's skills you can practice and develop, just like you can practice athletic skills or you can practice archery or whatever. And when you practice a skill, you generally improve. Mm-hmm. And then what you're just naturally able to do because you've improved increases. And so we can focus on practicing a skill, and then, mm-hmm. and then we can actually make some headway, as opposed to focusing on trying to make myself not get angry or make myself
not do something. Yeah,
exactly. And so I taught a class. I put this, some of the stuff together, and saw that stress was so important. So I taught was teaching a class on stress using the seven tools as the basis. And one of my daughters took that class right after college, and she was sort of wondering, well, what am I supposed to do with my life? And that class motivated her to go to graduate school and become a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. And so then she's been back in the Baltimore area for 7 or 8 years teaching her clients these issues and the same kind of stress class. And then she moved back out here and said, well, Dad, why don't we put this class online, mm-hmm. and share it with a bigger audience, you know? And
that's great.
So we spent several years working on that, and then we've just, this is our second year doing a summit and trying to collect a bunch of really knowledgeable people together in one place to address a topic. And it's just been great. It's a lot of work, but it's really enjoyable. Get to meet people like you and hear these amazing ideas. And so it gets me, because to me, I mean, I remember in third grade, back in, that was been in 1963 or something, you know, and the teacher put up this thing on a cork board in the back room that said conservation. And I remember sitting in the back of the room sounding out that word over and over again, and it hit me, that's a really good idea, you know. And I think I've been like an environmentalist ever since. Mm-hmm. So I have those values, but when I look at what you've actually done, I mean, do my practice and, you know, doing these seven tools.
But my stuff is all academic. You know, I have never raised an organic plant in my life. So,
oh, yeah, they grow themselves pretty easily. You know? But anyway, so you've got this climate psychiatry alliance. I'd like to hear more about that. And
yeah, we're a great group of people, if I do say so. I mean, we just have a lot of really great psychiatrists. Lisa Van Susteren has been really out in front leading in this area for a long time. She's a psychiatrist in Washington who did some forensic interviews for the kids that are in our Children's Trust lawsuit, and has really written a lot about the moral imperative to get going on this, and tremendous mentor and leader for the rest of us. And we have an activist, Robin Cooper, in San Francisco, and a longstanding activist slash community builder psychiatrist in Oregon, David Pollack, and mm-hmm. young psychiatrist, my partner Janice Lewis, who I write with, is a wonderful, thoughtful humanist in the East Coast, and just so many people that we're working together with. But basically what we try to do is we're just now a 501(c), so we can accept a little bit of donation and have an assistant to help with this. So we've been doing it in our free time as psychiatrists, but we try to post articles that come up about climate mental health issues. We try to keep a little bit of a library there about some important articles about things like heat and air pollution and how they affect the brain. And we have sort of an article of the week, and we have interesting links, and we're now building a referral base for therapists who consider themselves to be aware of the reality of climate change and able to help people with it. Because a lot of patients have had the experience of going to a therapist and saying, I'm really worried about climate change. And the therapist, doing what therapists do, says, I'm sure that's not the real worry. It must be something in your work or your family that's the real worry, right? And the therapist, because they're anxious themselves, can also get stuck sort of avoiding the topic, right? So we're trying to generate a network of people who can be working on how to be more receptive to this, more aware of the kinds of anxieties that come up for people.
Wow. So how can interested listeners get involved?
Well, absolutely. Click on the website links, CPA, Climate Psychiatry Alliance, and you'll find all sorts of stuff there, opportunities to get involved with us as a group, to contribute to the Twitter feed, to help us make little information packets that can go out about different climate mental health topics.
And make financial donations and things?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We are desperately needing about $20,000.
So, no, that's amazing to put that together. It reminds me of a bumper sticker I saw one time. It says, don't agonize, organize.
There you go.
And that's what you guys are doing.
I loved what you said about sitting in the back room with the word conservation and sounding it out, because it's really when you sit with conservation, right, that you start to think about conserving, right?
Yeah.
So you need some time with these words.
Yeah. And so one final last question. So if you could leave our listeners with three tidbits of advice to help if they or their children are experiencing eco-anxiety, what would they be?
Go out into nature with them.
Get into nature.
Them tell a new story of how they want the world to be in the future. And then help them do one thing towards making that future happen. Mm. So, you know, we had a little guy who was no more than 8 years old, who in the 2 years before we met him had convinced the entire PTA Association of, I think, California, maybe Southern California, that climate change was a children's health issue and therefore schools needed to engage it. And he had passed that resolution, you know.
Starting when he was six.
Yeah, starting when he was six. He was an amazing child, you know. So just putting your kids to work on something that they care about, you would be amazed how far it can go.
Mm. Excellent, excellent. Oh, well, thank you so much. We don't want this to end, but I know you've probably got places to go.
I do, actually. We'll say hello to some guests, so I'm going to do that.
Well, thank you again.